Good morning. And okay, this mic actually does work. Okay. So last time I was away at a conference, so Serge talked about forwarding and implementing forwarding some more. Yeah, some examples of kind of season hazards, and started talking about control hazards, sort of a problem that forwarding didn't really have a way of fixing, because, well, with forwarding, we figured out, oh, we don't actually need the value like right when we fetch the instruction, and because we fetched an earlier instruction, we had time to wait for the value to be computed, and we could send it, often without stalling, sometimes with a little bit of stalling. With control hazards, we don't even know what to fetch yet. So our solutions seem like basically just stalling, and it's kind of an awkward type of stalling because we have to, stall. We don't even know what instruction to fetch yet. We're going to talk about sort of the canonical solution, which I believe Serge alluded to very briefly, and we had a bit on the quiz, which is that we're going to make guesses. That's going to be the most common solution for control hazards, and it's going to work a surprising amount of the time. So before I start talking about things for today, questions about things that were covered last week? Okay, so I probably should go over certain quiz questions. I guess we're, and no questions on the quiz except probably, I guess I should go over quiz question three given. So for quiz question three, we had our processor, we had this pipeline stage split up into multiple pieces, presumably so we could get a faster clock rate. Yes?
I saw the decode should come only after the execute stage.
So the question is, aren't I making a mistake here because you're saying, okay, I need to forward a value from E2, and doesn't that need to get forwarded to decode? So the reason we were forwarding to decode is because of when the value needs to be used. And for this instruction, we need to use the value in these execute stages to do the subtraction. So we can, in fact, delay our forwarding until a little later. And that's why this timeline works, because we can forward from the end of execute to the end of that second decode, because we don't actually need to do the work that the decode stage normally does for R9. We can instead take the value of R9 from the previous instruction rather than reading it from the register file. And that two cycles of decode, presumably that meant that the register file was slow and takes two cycles. But we don't care about that when we're forwarding. We just need that mux to work fast enough. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Can I just directly forward E2 to E1?
So the question is, why wouldn't I do this forwarding path, E2 directly to E1? And our problem is that our value, if we think of what must be happening here, we have an ALU that's probably split into two. And what you're proposing is that we forward from here to here. Or alternately, because we have a value which is computed near the end of E2, and by that time, we want to be near the end of E1. Alternately, another way we could think about it is you're proposing that we forward, this value here, and we have like some mux that selects it here. But if we did that, now our critical path is going to be going all the way through this whole loop here, and that would kind of defeat the point of splitting up execute into two halves. Right, so we can't do that forwarding where we like send something from the final thing execute two does to the first thing execute one needs. Because in that case, we're effectively making one big critical path that's going to mean that we're going to have enough time in our clock cycle to do everything this last half of execute 2 would do and everything this first half of execute 1 would do, which means we didn't really get any benefit by splitting up execute into two stages. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so the forwarding we want to do is that we'd have some pipeline register that feeds, so we have E1, E2, and we'd be forwarding a value all the way to, we could forward to that pipeline register. In which case, in that case, we haven't made the critical path substantially longer, so we're not going to have to worry about increasing our cycle time. But if we try to take this shortcut where we say, we don't need this pipeline register. Well, we made the critical path a lot longer, so we're not going to be able to have the benefit of having more pipeline stages in terms of cycle time. Is that your question? Yes. So can I explain again why I can forward from E2 to D2 instead of E2 to D1 or earlier? So the purpose of our decode stage is to read the registers. When we're forwarding, we don't need to read that register anymore. So it doesn't matter if we go through all the decode stages with the value. We have this shortcut to get the value without reading the register, so we don't need both decode stages. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So to follow up on that, like in the instructions it says, you know, the input to decode has to go into D1, but because the input is the register index and not the actual value stored in the register, we can just type that straight into D2.
So the question is, in the question it said that the input to decode needs to be available in D1, but question is, did that not matter because that's just a register number? Exactly,
okay.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
For the MR move, is that execute stage only dependent on finishing the execute stage of add
queue? Question, for MR move queue, is this execute stage only dependent on finishing the execute stage of the add queue? Yes, and that's because all the values we need R9, we need 8, we're going to get 8 from fetching it, we're going to get R9 from forwarding it, probably this forwarding path, but could have some others.
So that's why the execute 1 of that stage can overlap with execute 2 of subcube.
And question, that's why the execute 1 of that stage can overlap with the execute 2 of subcube? Yes. Yeah.
I don't know if this was already asked, but for MR move queue, couldn't you still decode 1 after the fetch? Because decode 1 didn't necessarily need the value at R9, it needs the value of R9 at B.
So the question is, for the subqueue, couldn't I have done a decode 1 here?
For
MR move queue. Couldn't I have done a decode 1 here?
Yes.
And the answer is no, because we only have one decode 1 stage, and it can't do two things at a time. And if I put decode 1 there, I'd be asking to do the subtract decode 1 and the MR move queue decode 1 at the same time. So a question, after decode 1, decode 2 has to happen right after. So if it doesn't, we need to have some place to store the values that are going to be passed from decode 1 to decode 2. And our place to store it is the pipeline registers between decode 1 and decode 2, so we can only store one set of values, so we can't like mix up the instruction order. So there are processor designs where you might do mix up the instruction order for that sort of thing, but that requires a lot of extra machinery to track the values that we haven't passed yet. But on our processor, we only have one set of values that we can track going through from one stage to the next. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And okay, I didn't actually make the slide for it. So we got some anonymous feedback about Serge's teaching, which wasn't complimentary. I'd like to mention that Surge also sees the anonymous feedback. So please keep that in mind. The reason I didn't teach on Thursday and wasn't here is because I was in Toronto, so for a conference. And I think as far as there was a suggestion that having Surge teach smaller units, I don't think that's good for preparing teaching because it's actually trickier to prepare a little bit of stuff in a way that fits in with everything else. It's not actually so great. Okay, so we're going to move on to our main topic for today, which is going to be, was alluded to by quiz question 4. And this is saying that, oh, we don't know what the result of this branch instruction. So in this example, this is our branch instruction, because it, which is a conditional jump. We don't know what the true result of it is until the execute to stage, and we fetch the correct instruction a cycle later. So what that means is that we're going to fetch our add as usual. We're going to do our jump. And the reason why we don't know the true result, and I made a copy-paste error. So I guess I should just rewrite this the correct way. So this is E1, E2, M1, M2, M3, and W. The reason why we don't know the correct result yet is because in order to figure out what a jump less than equal does, we need the condition codes. And where are we going to compute the condition codes? Well, we're going to compute them when this subtract finishes, this add finishes adding. Yes?
Isn't that now missing the D2?
Isn't that now missing the D2 stage? Oh, that would, no, because this is a different example. What is missing is that that should just be D.
I think the quiz question had D1 and
D2. Okay. I see. So I just copied something very wrong. And hopefully I won't be annoyed by that. Okay. So hopefully I keyed the quiz right. 2M3. Yeah. Did I also get this wrong on the key? I guess no, I can't tell. Okay. 3W. So it should be D1, D2, and everything should be shifted over. Well, great. That's what I get for. So this should be D2, E1, E2, M1, M3. And this should be D1, D2, E1, E2, M1, M2, M3. So if we think of our jump, and that is not going to be clear at all, so we'll do D1, D2, and we'll have in blue, we'll have E1 and E2, and that's the important part, and this is going to be here. This is E2. We said after E2, we could fetch, so in this design, we'd be fetching here. And I guess I'll have some examples of this later that I didn't hastily put together last night and apparently not pay close attention to what I was writing down. But the key idea was that we determined when we fetched based on where the JLE is, because the JLE is computing the result of the jump. It's taking the conditions met value. And we want to do that in one of its execute stages because we want to wait until after the prior instruction here computes the result of the condition codes. So after we have that, we can send the value through here, compute the result, and then we can finally fetch the correct instruction afterwards, in this case, the MR move Q. Yes?
Yeah, I guess you're going to add up to make sure maybe that lines up with M2 instead of E1 then, since that was shifted over.
Does that line up with M2 instead of M1 in the key? Yeah. Did I actually? Yeah. Okay. Yes. I will. I will correct the key after election. So, yeah, because I just, yeah.
This doesn't affect the answer, but just the end up. There's also an IR move queue above that add queue that puts one already.
Yeah, the question is, there's also an IR move queue? Yes, that doesn't affect the answer, so I didn't write on this slide. That was intentional, but not. Being inconsistent about what the pipeline stages were was not intentional and probably a copy-paste error. So, okay. So the key thing here is that we can figure out what when the instruction gets fetched based on, you know, that description in the question. That we couldn't do it until earlier, and we did it as early as possible. And how early was that? Well, in the assumption we had here, we had to first compute the condition codes, and then we needed another cycle to figure out what the address was, and then we need another cycle to start fetching things. Yes, you could imagine maybe a processor design where you try to do, like, the start fetching and use the condition codes in one cycle, but that's going to maybe increase your critical path because you have to do the fetch and some condition code looking at stuff like that conditions map mux you did in CCLAB would have to happen in the same cycle as the fetch. So we're assuming that that's not practical for when we look at like how long the cycle time would be. And in the meanwhile, sort of our key observation is that what happens here is that we, while we're doing that, we don't just have our processor do nothing. We fetch some additional instructions. And this is going to be the key way that in the more common case, we're actually going to make our control hazards not be much of a performance issue. So the previous strategy we saw was that we could stall. And if we stall, we're going to get this same outcome here, where we have to wait until the jump gets far enough to use the condition codes before we can move on. But what we can do instead is we can make a guess. And in the quiz question, and also in our textbook, and in the processor you're going to have to make for pipe homework 2, the guess we're going to make, just a kind of arbitrary choice, is that we're going to guess that when we have a conditional jump, it goes to the label. That's not always going to be true, of course. Sometimes the instruction we actually run after this jump will be the XOR, not the add. But what we're going to do instead is we're going to guess that it's the add. And when our guess is right, we're just going to keep going. We're just going to act as if this is an unconditional jump, do the exact thing we would do for an unconditional jump, and it's, in fact, easier to implement than a conditional jump. Now, the problem comes in that, of course, that guess is not always going to be right. So when that guess is wrong, we're going to somehow have to forget this wrong answer before we go too far. And a question is, like, why is that practical? Why, you know, undoing instructions is not something we can always do. Why is that something I'm okay with doing here? How are we going to make that happen? Do we have to do a bunch of extra bookkeeping? And with our five-stage pipeline, the answer turns out to be no. And we can see that by looking at during what things get changed other than pipeline registers or the PC. So in the fetch stage, we change some pipeline registers, but we don't actually change anything else. So if we want to undo an instruction that's only done fetch, all we have to do is fix up the pipeline registers and fix up the program counter. In the decode stage, same thing. We read some registers, but that doesn't change anything other than the pipeline registers, which have those values we read. So if we want to undo something that made it to decode, all we have to do is fix up the pipeline registers. And that's going to be good enough. We only run into problems if instructions have gone further. If instructions have gone to execute and finish execute, well, they might have changed the condition codes. So that could be a problem. We'd have to, if we wanted to undo an instruction that made it to execute, we'd have to restore the old version of the condition code somehow, which means we would have to track what the old version of the condition codes was, have it someplace so we can put it back in the condition codes. And in memory, we might have written to memory. So if we wanted to undo an instruction that made it to memory, then we'd have to like remember what the old value there was and send it, write it back. That seems awfully annoying. And if we made it to write back, we also have to like undo register changes and, you know, undo a halt the processor sort of thing. But fortunately, we, when we're doing this branch prediction here, we're going to figure out what the outcome of the conditional jump outcome here, which means that the sort of the guessed instruction could be the two instructions that are behind it in the pipeline. Because remember, we fetch the jump goes through our pipeline up to execute. That means the two instructions we guessed are in decode and fetch, and no instructions have made it further. So we can just undo those instructions by just fixing the pipeline registers. We're not going to have to do any other bookkeeping. So that's going to make it, for this case, fairly easy. Now, in a more complex processor, they actually do undo instructions that make it further in the pipeline. We're not going to talk about in this class how you implement that, other than to say it involves a lot more bookkeeping. So, and we're going to see how to implement this in HCL a bit later. But the sort of hint is that it's just about manipulating the pipeline registers because we don't change anything else. So when we do this speculation correctly, so in this case, let's say we have this subtract here. If we did this speculation correctly, I probably should, we would go to label here. And we run this add, this rmove queue, this irmove queue, and so on. And we're just going to first fetch the add as if it's an unconditional jump. And in that case, you know, we're going to replace things where previously with stalling, we would just not be doing any work. So instead, we're doing some work. You know, this is kind of free. In the case where that guess was wrong, we're going to do what we'll call squashing these instructions that we guessed. So rather than letting the R move Q we fetched move from fetch to decode and letting the add Q we fetched move from decode to execute, we're going to get rid of them from our pipeline and replace them with a pipeline bubble, a no-op. So the result is going to be as if we had stalled the whole time. It's just that we have these two cycles where we were starting to execute these instructions that we couldn't finish. We made sure we didn't finish because it would be really bad if we accidentally modified R9 for this add that wasn't supposed to happen. And in addition to fixing these wrong instructions, we're also going to have to fetch the corrected next instruction. So we're going to have some special logic for setting the PC that realizes, no, you don't want to fetch the instruction that's here that we normally fetch after that RMove queue. We have this jump that hasn't completed yet. Fetch the instruction that this jump would actually go to since we guessed wrong. Questions about this procedure for when we make this guess and our guess is wrong? Yes?
You said the effect on the timing of it all would be that as if we just stalled, just wait and see if we guess wrong?
Question, the effect on the timing will be that just as if we stalled if we guess wrong? Yes. Except for like any added cycle time from the extra logic for this. Yeah?
Do you mind repeating the squashing part again?
Can I repeat the?
How you're talking about squashing when we get the wrong.
Can I talk about what squashing is? So squashing is what we call getting rid of instructions from our pipeline. And we're going to need to do that for our guesses that are wrong. Other questions? Yeah?
So,
the question is, how do we alter the PC?
Yeah.
So we're going to have some logic, which I have. Yes. We're going to have some logic to control the PC. If we're following the textbook, we're going to have a mux that determines what the actual PC value we use is to do that. So we'll talk about this later. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Which guess is made first?
Which guess is made first? What do you mean?
Like in the event that you have a jump or the next instruction, which one would we just...
Okay, so the question is, after a conditional jump, like, which we have two instructions we can guess, and like, and so in this case, we could guess this one or this one. Which one are we going to do? So our textbook authors have made the choice to always guess that the jump is taken, meaning it goes to the destination. And it turns out that empirically, if we look at real programs, that this sort of guess is right over 50% of the time. And if you want to think of why, if you think of loops typically have a jump from the bottom to the top of the loop, and that's more frequent than other types of jumps. So this tends to actually do okay. Real processors might make much more sophisticated guesses, and it turns out that with a rather sophisticated way of guessing that involves like having some using some cache-like data structures to remember what happened previously, you can get like a 99-point-something% accuracy. But we're not going to be doing that. We're going to keep things simple. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, why is the
memory changed to opcode?
Question, why did I write opq instead of subq? I just wasn't being consistent. But opq and subq, same instruction. So. Other questions? Yeah. So the question with squashing the instruction should be setting a mux on those values that are sent through the pipeline register. Exactly. And it turns out that HCL is going to have a built-in mux for that for us, so we don't even have to write the mux explicitly. We'll look at that later. Okay, so now that we've talked about branch prediction, let's talk about how it affects performance. So let's say I have a program here that has where 3% of my instructions are conditional jumps that are not taken, 5% are conditional jumps that are taken, so the taken prediction is right a little more than 50% of the time, but not that much. I have 1% returns, and I have 91% other instructions. And if we assume forwarding just always lets us avoid stalling, which I know isn't quite true, but we'll use that approximation here, then our non-taken conditional jumps with prediction take 3 cycles because we have 1 cycle to fetch the jump and 2 additional cycles wasted fetching other things that don't actually matter. And with stalling, they also took 3 cycles. We had 1 cycle fetching the jump, 2 cycles stalling. The taken ones now take 1 cycle because we predict them correctly, predicting everything is taken. And with stalling, they took 3. So that's our benefit here. And our returns, because we're going to have to stall for them, I haven't actually talked about how can we predict a return. Turns out real processors do that. We're not going to talk about how. It turns out that is something you can do. But we're not going to. So they're going to take 4 cycles. We don't have prediction for them. So we're going to have 1 cycle to fetch the return and 3 more cycles to wait for the return address to be read and available. And our other instructions, we're going to assume they just take 1 cycle. So my question is here, how much faster is it with prediction? I'll give you some time to work that out. And to compute this, I would typically compute a number of cycles per instruction. So that's the sort of unit I would compute, kind of our throughput. So these are throughput numbers here. who'd like some more time? Okay, so who can tell me what's a good first step to compute this? Okay, any volunteers? Okay, apparently not, so I'll go through what I do. So I want to compute kind of, here I have, for each of these instructions, I have the sort of their throughput, like how fast they'll be. And we have this mix of instructions, so I want to compute a weighted average of how fast instructions will be. So for prediction, I know it take 3% of the instructions take 3 cycles, 5% take 1 cycle, 1% takes 4 cycles, and 91% takes 1 cycle. So I have a weighted average based on those percentages. And I find out that we have an average time of 1.09 cycles instruction, given that these are the programs we're running, have this mix of instructions. If I do the same computation for stalling, I get 1.19 cycles instruction. So I find out that we're about 9% faster. And this is kind of remarkable because many people's intuitions about this sort of branch prediction might be that, oh, we need to be very accurate. No, we don't. Here, we're barely more than 50% right, and we're getting a pretty big improvement, even though most of our instructions aren't even branches. Like, very few, like 5% of the instructions were affected, less than 10% of them were branches. So this is a really beneficial sort of processor design thing to do, and even more beneficial if we could get that accuracy up above this like 60-ish percent number. Questions on this calculation here? Okay, so let's do here. So let's say we're doing we have our branch prediction and our forwarding. I'm going to work out what's the timeline here? What's fetched when with our normal pipeline, and what's forward? Use some time to work that. And I have the instructions in the order they should complete, not necessarily the order they appear in assembly, because this is not the label foo. Sub Q is not where foo is, because that's not where we go in this junk. Okay, who'd like some more time? So I'll go through my solution. So first thing that happens is we fetch our add, and it just goes through our pipeline stages. We fetch our conditional jump, and then we're going to make a prediction. In this case, we're predicting it is taken, but it's not taken. So we're going to fetch two other instructions that are going to not turn out to matter, really. But that's what our pipeline is for. And once we get to cycle three here, our add is going to have finished its execute, which means that we're going to be passing the values of our condition codes to the jump. And now the jump can use that to decide what to do. And we're going to figure out that, oh, okay, we did the wrong thing. We didn't really want to go to foo. We've just run these two instructions here to B and to C that we don't care about. So we're going to get rid of them in their pipeline. So we're going to still have something in our pipeline because we can't put nothing in a register, but we're going to replace these with nops. So they're going to be squashed and replaced with nops, which is what I'm representing with these sort of faded letters here. And we're also going to somehow send our corrected program counter value to the fetch stage. So in the next cycle, we don't fetch 2D, we fetch 3. And this is going to happen to mean that even though our 9 is the same register between 1 and 3, that we don't actually have to forward it, because by the time we're doing the decode stage of the subtract, it's already written in this example. So we're going to keep going with these instructions, and we're going to have some forwarding that needs to happen. So from instruction 3 to instruction 5, well, instruction 3 writes our 9, instruction 5 reads our 9 and writes it to memory. And it's not going to read our 9 in time unless we forward it, so we're going to need to forward it. Yeah?
So when you realize that it's misinterpreted, do you always stop at decode stage?
So question, when we realize it's mispredicted, we always stop at decode stage? So we stop at the stage that where we figure out the outcome of the jump. And that's going to have to be after we have the right condition code values. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And there's one more forwarding, which a lot of people miss here, which is that this call instruction, if we remember how call works, it writes to the stack, it updates the stack pointer because it pushes something on the stack. And the push instruction also needs to update the stack pointer, so it needs to read the old stack pointer. So we're also going to have to forward the stack pointer value from call to push. Questions? Okay. And so I'll go through an example of this. Let's say we had a pipeline here where I split the execute stage in two. Let's look at how that would change things. So with that, my add here, I need to wait till the second execute stage to get the value of the condition codes. And that means that my jump is not going to be able to finish as early, which means that in this example, we need to fetch three instructions, and one of them is going to make it to execute one by the time we figure out what the actual outcome of the conditional jump is. Once we have that, we can fetch the corrected instruction, and everything proceeds as before, except that our push instruction is going to need to have a stall because we can't get the value of the new stack pointer in time for it to start execute one right away. So that stall is for RSP from call. We need to wait for it to be available. So questions on this example here? Yes?
You might have gone through this, but like, why we need to forward R9 from the memory stage of some queue to decode instead of pointer?
So the question is, why am I forwarding from memory instead of XQ2? My assumption is I'm following the path. I could forward indeed to here, but then I would need to somehow track that I already forwarded the value. And usually we'll find when we're thinking about how to implement forwarding logic that it's actually very annoying to do. So probably I'm going to have my forwarding logic is going to say, oh, what register do I want to read? Where is it in the pipeline? And we're going to find it and at this time from memory. So we're going to end up taking that value.
Because the stack pointer from call is only forwarded at its E2, so it has to wait.
So the question is, do we have to wait because of stack pointer for call? Exactly, yeah. So we can't actually finish the decode stage during cycle 8 because call's stack pointer value isn't ready, even though, yes, we could get over 9 at that time. Yes?
I think this was covered in the past lecture, but after, not for this particular example, but after we calculate something after the execute, the value, and I guess, let's say it's R9, can we forward that value any time after it's been already calculated? Like, if we want to do it before this one time after?
Question is, well, after we compute R9, can we forward it from any stage we want to? Yes, because it's still going to be in our pipeline registers until it's actually written to the register file.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, so we've talked a bit about branch prediction and forwarding, sort of conceptually, and we talked about implementing forwarding. We haven't talked about implementing stalling or implementing branch prediction, as far as what the HCL code looks like. So that's what we're going to talk about next. We're going to talk about how do we implement stalling, how do we implement forwarding, and we're going to talk about them together because how we implement them is essentially controlling what our pipeline registers do. And there's two big things we want to control. So one thing we want to do is we often want to hold a value in a pipeline register to keep it for the next cycle. So one example of this is in this example here, where we wanted to kind of repeat the decode stage of the push to wait for the value to be available. You know, this is the kind of logic we want. We want to take the values that we were decoding, the register indices, and use them again the next cycle because we didn't actually do it. So we want some mux on our pipeline registers that's going to say, you know, repeat the old values rather than taking in new ones. We also sometimes need to insert a NOAP. So this occurs for our squashing. And this also occurs when we're stalling because, well, if the decode stage needs to be repeated, the execute stage doesn't have data to do stuff with. We shouldn't pass through the value from decode to execute if it's not valid. We should instead make the execute stage do nothing. How do we do that? We pass values for a NOAP. So we're also going to want some muxes that let us select a value corresponding to a NOAP. And you could make these muxes by hand, but HCLRS has these register banks, and these register banks have two built-in signals, one of which you've used. So there's a signal called stall, which keeps the old value for all registers. You can also think of this as a write-disable signal. And there's a signal called bubble, which restores the default value for all registers. You can think of this also as a reset signal. And the way we're going to use this is by keeping the old value, is that's when we want to repeat a stage. We're going to set that stall signal. It's going to keep it the same. The bubble signal, we're going to set our default values to be NOAPs. And we kind of have to do that anyways, because when our processor starts up, we don't like want the write back stage to write something when there's no instruction there that made it there yet. So we're going to have our defaults be NOAP anyways. So by resetting to the defaults, we'll put a NOAP in that pipeline stage in the next cycle. And the way these signals work is that these determine what the register's value will be in the next cycle. So we're going to set, if we set bubble now, in the next cycle, the B register will have a default value instead of whatever value we were sending to its input. So let's go through how that works. So here I have a timeline with the cycle numbers, and I'm saying initially, A value, which remember is our input to this register, so we have A underscore value, and I have capital B underscore value. So initially, A value is 1 by something that's not shown in this HCL code, and B value is the default value because we just started of FF, and my stall signal is 0, and my bubble signal is 0. So my question is, during cycle time 1, what is B value and so on? So let's go through, check with your neighbor, see if you can figure out what happens in this case. And I guess to get us started out, During the first cycle, stall and bubble are both zero, so the register is going to behave normally. So what normally happens in the register? Well, if we put, say, 15 here, we would get 15 here in the next cycle, right? So the answer for our first part is we're putting 1 here, so we're going to get OX1 as the output in the next cycle. But then our operations are affected by these stall and bubble signals. Yes.
Does the default value only happen when there's no previous instruction?
Question, does the default value only happen when there's no previous instruction? So it happens at the beginning, and it happens in the next cycle when we set the bubble signal. So the bubble signal resets, makes it the next cycle behave like the first one would happen. Question, if the bubble signal is 1, then the B value would be the default in the next cycle, yes. Question?
Yeah, what would be the default value?
What would be the default value? That we specify right here in our declaration of the register bank. And when you're making your processor, you probably want to make sure those values are good for NOPs, or else, well, when your processor starts, it won't do things that are useful. Well, we'll do wrong things that aren't NOPs, and also you won't be able to use this bubble idea to implement stalling. Would like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay, so any volunteers tell me what happens at time 2 to B value? Yes? So it stalls, so it would be 1 again, yes. So, okay, and that's, so stalling disables the write, so we keep the 1. How about during cycle 3? Anyone? Yeah. There's a 3. So during cycle 2, everything was normal. So we just send the value of 3 from the input to the output. Note that it doesn't matter that we happen to be setting bubble for the next cycle that doesn't take effect yet. So then we have our bubble signal set, and that means that rather than writing 4, we're going to end up replacing it with our default value. So that write of 4 is going to be blocked and replaced by our default value. We're going to reset the thing instead. Then we have a normal cycle. We're going to put in 05. And then, how about next? So someone, for the, yeah.
It stalls so at 5 again.
It stalls so at 5 again. So that's going to happen later. But remember the stall, so all these stall and bubble signals, they affect the value the next cycle. So you don't want to look at what stall is going to be, you want to look at what it is now. Yeah.
6.
So we're just going to do the normal thing right now. Okay, how about, can you do the next one?
Oh, it stalls, so it's 6 again.
Okay, stalls, so it's 6 again. And how about after that? What?
Stalls again, so it's 6 again.
And after that, it stalls, so it's still 6. The stall isn't go back a cycle, it's just keep the same value. So we can stall multiple times in a row, and we have the same value stay there for more time. So questions, how this works. Okay, so now that we know about these signals, let's talk about how to use them to control what instructions are in our pipeline. So we can think of having pipeline registers from fetch to decode. And let's say I want to manufacture this situation. So I have decided that I have currently instructions E, D, C, B, A in my pipeline in fetch to write back. And I want to make it so instruction B moves from memory to write back. I want to make instruction C stay and execute. In order to do that, I'm going to not only keep instruction C and execute, I should here, but I'm also going to make a not go into memory stage so I don't have 2 copies of instruction C. And I want to keep instruction E in fetch. And in order to do that, I'm going to put a not in decode. And in this case, I've apparently decided to get rid of instruction D. To squash it. My question is, how do I set my pipeline register bank's stall and bubble signals to make this happen? And I've represented them. I have fetch to decode, decode to execute, execute to memory, and memory to write back. And yes, we're going to have to do something with the PC register. We'll talk about that especially, so we're not going to deal with that in this exercise. And I guess to make things clear, I'm talking about the signals we would set during cycle 1. Would you like some more time? Okay, so let's start with our fetch to decode. So what? Who thinks that this should be a set? We should set stall for our fetch to decode. We should set keep things normal, no stall or bubble. We should set bubble. Okay, so we have consensus on bubble, and that's because that's how we're going to get that knob there that wasn't there before. So we're going to end up setting, it's going to turn out to be, this is going to correspond to bubble underscore d equals 1 during cycle 1. And how about our decode to execute? Who thinks we should set stall? Thinks we should set bubble? Thinks we should set neither of them? Okay, so who has no clue? There's more people who didn't answer. Okay, so we have a split between we should set neither of them or we should set stall. So if we think of what would happen normally here, normally what would happen is that we'd end up with not C here, but with D here. And we don't want that. So we're going to have to do something other than not setting stall or bubble to make that happen. And if we set bubble, we'd end up with a not there, not C. If we set stall, we're going to keep the same values that were coming out earlier, which was the values for C. So we want to set the stall signal in this case. So setting the stall signal on the decode to execute is going to mean that execute is going to have the same input the next cycle that it had previously, and the previous input was C. So it's going to be C again. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay, how about our execute to memory? Who thinks we should set stall? Should set bubble? Neither? Okay, we have reasonable consensus for bubble, okay, which I agree with. How about from memory to write back, our final one? Who thinks we should set stall? We should set bubble. We should set neither. And that should be normal because normally B would go from memory to write back, and we still want that to happen. Questions on this example? That is, in fact, let's just quickly do a different example without this one. So fetch to decode. Who thinks we should set stall? Here. Who thinks we should set bubble? Who thinks we should set neither of them? So I have good consensus for neither, because we normally E would go from fetch to decode. That's what we want to happen. How about decode to execute? Who thinks we should set stall? Who thinks we should set bubble? Thinks we should set neither? Okay, so we have great consensus now for this is a stall case. And how about execute to memory? Who thinks we should set stall? How about bubble? Okay, and I think we have consensus for that. And our memory to write back again is normal. So probably comfortable with that. So we saw sort of how we implement the pipeline register management part of stalling, and also branch prediction. We're going to just figure out what instructions we want where. We can set the stall and bubble signals to do that. We'll go into more detail about that in our remaining minutes of class. So we also are going to need to handle updating the PC. So that's typically going to be some extra logic in addition to manipulating the pipeline registers. And we're going to have to do is stalling. So let's look at what stalling actually involves. And something that people often miss is that, well, in this case, I'm stalling this subtract instruction here. So what does that mean I'm doing? Well, I need to not only have the subtract instruction repeat decode, I need to make sure the execute stage has something to do. So I'm going to insert a knock. So here, I'm going to have to do something to keep the same stuff in decode by setting stall D. I'm also going to have to deal with the fetch stage, because if I don't deal with the fetch stage, then this IR move Q instruction I just fetched, it will go away. So I need to keep that IR move Q and fetch behind my subtract. So I'm going to need to do some logic for that. And we could do that by either adjusting the logic for FPC or by setting the write disable, the stalling, the PC register. I would recommend the latter for reasons we'll talk about later. And we also need to insert that knob, right? If we don't do that, then what's going to happen is instead of this being an inserted knob, we would have another copy of the same subtract. And that would be bad. It would be bad to fetch an instruction once and end up having two copies of it in our pipeline. We'd run the instruction twice. That would result in really weird results, especially since we wouldn't have the right values for RBX and RCX. So we don't want to do that. So we have this bubble to keep the subtract from moving on and have the execute instruction have something to do. Some questions about sort of why we're doing both this setting this stall signal and the bubble signal implement this pipeline stall. And our other case was misprediction for jump. So for that, we're going to fetch our predicted instructions, and then we're going to replace them with a knob. So we're going to have, during cycle 3, we're going to want to set the bubble signal for E and D. So in the next stage, these instructions don't move on. Instead, we have a knob in their place. So how is that going to look? So here that, you know, if we think of our diagrams from before, we're going to have these two knobs. We're going to insert by setting two bubble signals when the jump gets to the right place. And if we think of it in this way, we can think of how do we implement this in HTLRS. So we want to do, during this cycle, we want to set bubble D equals 1 and bubble E equals 1. But we don't want to always set it to 1. Like, we want to set it to 1 based on the J and E here. So we want this to imply that. So in HTLRS, how can we make it so we set bubble D and bubble E to 1 based on our jump just having gotten there and found out that we mispredicted? So the sort of code we're going to write, probably in HTLRS, is we're going to say, A, if we're in the execute stage of a jump and it wasn't taken, we're going to have to work on how to compute that exactly, then we're going to say, OK, well, that's a reason we would set bubble D and bubble E. So this is the sort of logic we're going to have for that. And generally, when we're doing these sorts of decide to stall or bubble things, we're going to have this sort of thing where we compute, do I need to stall? Do I need to squash instructions and so on, based on the instructions presumably later in the pipeline, similar to how you have your conditions for forwarding. You know, here we have a condition for squashing based on what happened to the jump instruction. Just like with forwarding, it's what happened to the instruction that's computing the value. Some questions? How I came up with this HCL code here. And we have a similar problem here for return. So when we're doing return, we're going to want to stall the return. But part of that is that we don't want to execute the return multiple times. So if we just kept fetching the return over and over again and passing it through our pipeline, that wouldn't be great because we'd execute returns several times. We also don't want to execute some other random instruction. So what we can do is we can, instead of passing a return or some other instruction to the decode stage, we'll pass a knob. So we'll insert a knob every time. How do we do this? Well, we're going to do this by setting bubble D to put the default values in, give us a knob. And when do we want to do this? Well, we're going to want to do this until the return makes it far enough that we can actually figure out what to fetch later. So how can we figure out if a return's in the pipeline? Any ideas? How could we know that we're in these cases where we want to insert the bubbles? What could we look for? So I want to insert this bubble because I have this return here, right, that hasn't made it all the way through the pipeline. How can I tell if I have a return that hasn't made it all the way through the pipeline? Like an HCL code. What would I want to look at? Yeah. Could we look at like the I code in the write by register? So looking at the I code in the write by register would tell us when we're here. And we could look at the I code in the other registers to tell us when we're at the other stages. So exactly. So one way we can write this is we can say, is return in decode? If so, we want to bubble. If it is an execute, we want to bubble. And if return's in decode, that's detecting this situation here. If it's an execute, that's detecting this situation here. So we can just query that directly by looking at those I code values in our pipeline registers. So questions, how I came up with that logic? Okay, so now let's talk about building RPC updates. So we kind of glossed over that part. So go through our cases. Most of these we've seen before for the first few. So we have our normal case where we add the instruction length. We have a case where we take an immediate value, which is going to be where we go for a call or unconditional jump, and it's going to be our prediction for a conditional jump. And we just have a mux to decide between those two. We also have to stall sometimes. So conceptually, we'll have a mux here. We could use the built-in mux, or we could implement this ourselves. It doesn't really make much of a difference because there's only one value, unlike you don't have like a register bank with tons of different PCs. There's just one. And the way our textbook does things is our textbook renames this set value from the PC to what they call a predicted PC. And they make corrections to this prediction rather than making them in the cycle before, they make them just before we fetch the instruction. So they add a mux after the register where they handle correcting the misprediction. So they'll get a value from the conditional jump instruction that just figured out in the previous cycle that, oh, we need to go somewhere else. They'll get the place to go from there, and we'll have to pass through the pipeline registers for that jump, like the alternate location to go. And they'll also get the return address for a return via this mechanism. And these values, well, our immediate value, that's from the instruction memory. These other two values here are going to be from our pipeline registers for the return or for the conditional jump. So either from the return's write-back stage, we're going to fetch the thing that we want to fetch based on the return and write-back. We want to fetch now, so we're going to get that value. So if we think of here, we have a return and write-back, so we're going to use its memory to write-back registers to send the value, the address of the instruction, in this case an add queue to fetch. And for a conditional jump, the conditional jump will have just finished its execute stage and computed the value where to go. We're going to, at the beginning of the jump's memory stage, we're going to fetch the address to go to and use that. Okay. And I would say this is the textbook's design. You could also do a design where we combine these two muxes and move everything off a cycle, but that's just not what the textbook does. But yes, you would have a working processor and you could pass pipe homework 2 with it. But I'm showing you what the textbook does, so you can refer to the textbook and not be too confused, hopefully. So questions on this PC update process? Yeah?
So the mux that we're adding for the branch prediction, is that the one in front of the prediction?
So the question is, what part of this is added for the branch prediction? So this mux input here is dealing with correcting a branch misprediction. For adding making the prediction part, we are just actually using this existing mux signal here we already needed for unconditional jumps. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Okay. So now that we're done, we have a, the processor we're going to implement has a 5-stage pipeline. We complete one instruction every cycle, except when we have hazards. For most data hazards, we solve them by forwarding. When we have a load followed by a use, we found out that, we get the value in memory and the execute of the previous next instruction isn't finished yet, so we had a cycle of stalling for that case. And we have some penalties for control hazards. So for a mispredicted jump, we have this 2-cycle penalty. Like, we don't spend those 2 cycles doing nothing, but we spend those 2 cycles doing something that's wrong, and we have to forget about it. And for return, we have 3 cycles of stalling that we have to do. And that's where we're going to finish up today. So next time, we're going to talk about demystifying the data and instruction memory. So we have this sort of data instruction memory that kind of work very fast, and that turns out to be unrealistic. So we're going to talk about, how good can we get that, and how does that work, and it's going to be with caches.